ABC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norton, Dillis Powell, and Frank Gar. First, a vocabulary round. 2 marks if you can tell me the meaning of the following words. Anne Scott James.
What is a patty pan?
Oh, the pie and the patty pan.
Yes, that's what I wanted.
Was one of Beatrix Potter's books.
Yes.
Well, we know what a pie is, so a patty pan is a little thing in which you, a little cooking utensil.
It is, but does your dough ever sort of sink into the middle of the pie when you're cooking?
Oh, no, not mine. I make sure it rises properly.
All right, two it is. Patty pan is, for most people, a pan for cooking patties in, but as Anne mentioned Beatrix Potter's story, The Pie and the Patty Pan, I've got to quote Beatrix Potter. I put in a little tin patty pan to hold up the crust. It's that little upside-down egg cup.
I always use an egg cup.
That you put in the middle in order that the crust doesn't go down, zonk, into the goo. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is a poor beagle? P-O-R-B-E-A, just like beagle. Poor beagle.
Not an underprivileged hound. Not allowed to be in at the kill. I know this. Yeah. It's a shark.
Mm-hmm. What kind of shark?
It's seen off Cornwall.
Yes.
So it's a basking shark, presumably.
No, but it's seen off Cornwall. All right. Yes, that's good enough. It's a thing I think called the mackerel shark, which is about 10 feet long, which is pretty alarming, and with a snout, a rather extended snout. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, what's the meaning of the word spelt? U-N-K-I-N-G.
U-N-K-I-N-G.
What's that mean?
Unking. Oh, well, to cut the head off a royal personage.
That would be a bit unkind, as well as unking.
It is unkind.
Any other way of doing it?
Well, dethrone.
That's what I wanted. Two. unking means... Unking means dethrone, to cause to abdicate, or to deprive a country of a king, like unhorse, meaning taking the horse away from the chap. Now, Dennis Norton, what's the meaning of the word, and it's adopted from a French word, couvade, C-O-U-V-A-D-E, couvade?
Yes, I know this. Actually, my dentist told me about this, because it is a dentistry thing. Actually, when dentists tell you something, you're apt to take it in, because you can't really but apparently, and the dentists do get lots of cases of this, that it's generally among fairly newly married couples, not that newly married, that when the wife is pregnant, and particularly when she's getting labour pains, the husband gets a sort of sympathetic toothache. This is apparently quite true. And what he said was interesting is it doesn't work the other way round. In other words, if the husband has something wrong with him, you don't get the wives trotting along with toothache. And that's called couvade. And
absolutely right, Dennis. 2 marks.
Brilliant.
It's sort of faintly interesting that in Corsica, when a woman is having a baby, that the husband is cosseted.
Yes, that's it, yes.
For exactly the same reason.
This is couvade, that's it. Yeah, absolutely right. Well, before we begin the next round, I read out a quotation for each team to write down, and I hope the two women members will study them, because at the end of the program I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, yours is, there is no accounting for taste. And Dennis Powell and Frank, yours is, parting is such sweet sorrow. And in the last round, I shall ask Dennis and Frank, to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Well, now a round of unfamiliar phrases, which were once commonly heard and nowadays probably not so. One mark for explaining the meaning, and a second mark if you can put it into context. I'm given an expression, example of the correct use of it. Anne Scott James, the black ox has trodden on your foot.
Well, it's a very painful thing to happen.
Sure.
And unlucky, too.
Unlucky, yes.
Yes, and...
Comes from...
What it sounds like. It sounds like one of those things that spies greet each other with.
It comes from witchcraft, I think.
A man will say to you, the black ox has trodden on your
foot. It's sort of
John, you will say...
John Buchanish.
Yes.
That's right, yeah. Can you derive it from anything a bit earlier than that, Anne? It's...
Perhaps it's a Latin.
Yes, it goes back certainly to that. I think I'm being a bit unfair. We'll settle for 1.5. It means you've been unlucky, that misfortune has come your way. It can mean for men that you're just being henpecked. But it's the black ox, which was sacrificed to the god of the underworld, Pluto, and therefore infernal happenings were all around you. Frank Muir, to stand upon one's pantoffles, P-A-N-T-O-F-L-E-S, or if you prefer it, it can be pantables.
Yeah.
Pantoffles or pantables.
It's a slipper,
yes.
But a special form of slipper, hence the expression. Rather like the shoes that the ladies wore in Venice, mm-hmm. to keep them off the mud.
And therefore the phrase means what, Frank? To stand upon your pantoffles?
To stand on your pantable.
Or pantable.
As I know it, is means to stand on your dignity.
Absolutely
you're
right.
Higher.
Mm.
You know, you can sort of rear up and sneer at people lower than you.
Well, Frank, 3 marks for special erudition this time, because you've got the 2 points. The in this phrase, to stand on your pantoffles or pantables, it's probably the high cork shoes, known as pantoffles, which actors use to make them seem even taller and grander than they were, add dignity to their performance. But it also was the loose slippers worn by Orientals. Same word. You've got both of those. 3 marks. To dispel... Out of all scotch and notch.
It means you haven't got any whiskey in the house.
It hasn't been notch. Not
and,
notch.
And no notch either, no.
Is it nautical?
No.
Not nautical.
No.
Means out of all knowledge.
Yes, near enough. Not far from
near that. Enough.
It means beyond all bounds, beyond the limits. The scotch is a line marked on the ground, for instance, in games children play, like hopscotch, or it can be a scratch or incision, and literally a score, which is something that you score across something else. The notch is a nick or a mark for keeping a score or keeping a record. Dennis Norden, all the traces have the wind in their faces, and the traces have got a capital T, and S-T-R-A-C-Y-S. All the traces have the wind in their faces.
I think that's what you reply when a spy says to you that the black ox has trodden on your foot. You say all the traces have the wind in their face. He then hands over the plans.
He might well, because it's a kind of curse.
Is it? I think what they did was when they were sitting round the dining table, they never put their hand up in front of their mouths when they should do. So all of them had the wind in their face. I don't think I'm going to get this by any process of logical deduction. I think I have to make some kind of imaginative leap, which I don't feel is in me.
There were 4 chaps who murdered an archbishop.
Are we talking about Thomas
Becket? Yes, we are. That's what I'm talking about. Those who do wrong will get their deserts. And it was William de Tracy, who was perhaps the nastiest and most active of the knights, who assassinated the Archbishop Thomas Becket. And for centuries afterwards, they were saddled with this curse. Wherever by land or sea they go, forever the wind in their faces shall blow. Now a round which the compiler has labelled rather learnedly, etymological imports. Which means
words
filched from other languages and then later incorporated into the English language. 2 marks, I want you to tell me the language or country of origin, and a consolation mark if you get it in the right continent and not quite so clear about the actual country. Anne Scott James, bosh. And I mean by this nonsense. Bosh.
Should we try the continent first?
Yes, try the continent first.
Europe.
No.
America. Australia. Asia.
Asia.
Asia, of course it is, like Tarbush. It's one of
that's
those.
That's right, you're getting nervous. Yeah.
Oh, Persian.
You're so near there, I'll give you one and a half.
Turkish.
Yes, that's it. But I did give you lots of chances.
Turkey in...
That's right, it is Turkish. In the Turkish language, bosh means empty, worthless, so on. And that crept into the English language and bosh turned up all over the place. Now, Frank Muir, ketchup. As in the phrase, tomato, ketchup.
Ketchup is stuff very closely resembling, both in appearance and taste, red lead. It's a sort of squashed up puree of tomato, also yes. called catsup.
Yes, and derives from?
I associate it with America, and I would very strongly suspect that like...
But when Columbus got to America, where did he think he'd got to?
Isle of Wight. Well, he was aiming for the Indies.
And beyond, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, he was hoping to get
China.
Around the world. And
that's right. So I wanted. It derives from the Chinese.
Chinese?
Koi chap, which is a brine of pickled fish. Dillis Powell, your turn. Slogan.
Slogan. Scottish.
Yes.
Scottish.
Which language?
Gaelic.
Yes, what I wanted. Yes. Do you know what it means?
Originally?
Mm-hmm.
It means a war cry.
Absolutely right. Well
done.
In Gaelic, it means an army cry or a war cry, and hence a party cry, a motto, and later a catchphrase. Case of a word going downhill. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, booby. I mean, in the sense of silly ass or fool. Booby. Country of origin.
Booby. Looks vaguely Asian.
That's Fernando Poe. In fact, they had people called boobies. Now, get a bit south of the Pyrenees, that'll help.
Awful, it's...
South of the Pyrenees, come on, that'd be Spain and Portugal, dear.
Yes, it's Spanish. A Spanish word, bobo, meaning a fool, a lubberly lout, the boy at the bottom of the class. And there's also a seabird of the Gannet tribe, which is absurdly easy to catch, and so stupid, it's called a booby, too. Well, now we come to the last round. And I go back to those quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks, and Scott James, the origin of yours, please. There is no accounting for taste.
Well, I think it's a proverb.
Put it into another language, and I'll give you 2 marks.
I think it's a Latin proverb.
Yes. Do you remember what the Latin was?
It's de something or other, known as disputandum.
Yeah, that's good enough.
De
gustibus.
Gustibus, we think.
De gustibus, known as disputandum. There is no accounting for taste, a Latin proverb. How did this power? The origin of yours. Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Romeo and Juliet.
Yep.
Juliet speaking.
Quite right. It's in the end of the balcony scene, and Romeo has to go back home. Parting is such sweet sorrow. Shakespeare. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their improbable explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir, and his was... Parting is such sweet sorrow.
I was walking the other evening in a little lane between Greek Street and Dean Street in Soho. It was in the evening, about 7 o'clock. And I came across a lady lying in the gutter. Also quite near the gutter. She had on, as I recall, I haven't much an eye for these things, but a dark brown velvet long dress. She was clutching a handbag. She had silver shoes, silver hair, silver sort of blue hair, and she was looking at the stars. So I said, Madam, are you going to have a come over? And she said, rather coolly, no, I'm going to the theatre. So I said, well, why are you supine? And she said, I'm reserving a place for my husband to park the Rolls.
Well,
only mention this because it ties in with a letter I had from a fan of this programme, Mr. Herbert Derwent of Durinallum, Western District, Victoria, Australia, who's coming back to England after nearly 20 years. He told me about this and said he'd like to come along and see the show. And he said, and he told me all about his details of his trip, and he was thinking of hiring a car. And is it easy to park a car in London? Well, it's not all that difficult. I mean, there's nothing illegal about parking a car in London. You know, it's as open to anybody as landing a Boeing 747 in Cricklewood Broadway. There are difficulties, Mr. Derwent, there are difficulties. There's a sort of system you have to get used to, which people who are strange to London don't usually get used to very quickly. There was an American tourist who was asking an Irish traffic warden about these things and said, what does the yellow line mean? And the traffic warden said, it means you can't park at all. So I said, well, what's the meaning of two yellow lines? There was a slight pause, and the Irish traffic warden said, it means, sir, you can't park at all. Generally speaking, Mr. Derwent, when you come over here, you'll find that the parking meters that you have to park up again. The normal drill is to cruise gently around until you find an empty space, an empty parking meter, whereupon the car in front of you goes into it. So what I want to say, Mr. Derwent, is if you come to London, don't really reckon on car parking, because finding a space in London is, well, in Shakespeare's words, parking is search, sweat, sorrow.
When I come to Dennis, there is no accounting for taste.
I was told about a London schoolboy whose teacher asked him to give an example of pop art, and he said, an electric toaster. And when the teacher looked puzzled, he said, because if you put a piece of bread in it and you wait a couple of minutes, you'll see it pop art. The burden of my story is that is exactly what was not happening with my electric toaster. And as a consequence, my whole day was being ruined. You see, I come from a family whose firmest belief is that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Anyway, you can now appreciate why the mechanical failure of my electric toaster cast a blight over the whole day. The bread was not popping up at all. It just sat inside. The only way to judge how much it was toasted was by decoding the smoke signals it sent. In other words, a small bluish wisp meant a sort of ginger coloured. Black billowing puffs get the butter knife ready to start scraping. Well, after a fortnight or so of ruined and charcoal-tasting slices, I realised there was nothing for it. I just have to take the appliance to be seen to. Now, in our modern technological society, there's only one type of man who laughs when things go wrong. That's the man who gets paid for repairing the thing that's gone wrong. In my case, it's a chap we used to call the little man at the electrical shop. He's now referred to as that gentleman who owns the big house with the double garage. So I booked an appointment with him, and I trudged round with the toaster. And sorry, he calls out. The minute I set foot in the door, sorry, he said, I can't touch a thing before Christmas. This was New Year's Day. I said, if you'll just advise me,
So he said, all right. He said, what's the problem? I said, my popper is not working. He said, well, as long as your mum's got a job. Now, there is an old Polish proverb to the effect, there is nothing so funny as a rich man's joke. So obediently I rolled about and gasped for breath and slapped my thigh for a few minutes, after which he consented to examine the toaster. Finally, after looking at it, he said, the spring has lost its tension. Leave it here. I'll let you have it back soon as I get round to it. Which turned out to be 8 months. 8 months, during which my time was spent either burning the toast beyond all redemption under the grill, or wasting half the morning trying to brown it on the immersion heater. But finally, we got the toaster back, and the following morning, feeling very cheerful, I put a piece of bread into it, reached for the newspaper, and I'd only just begun to unfold it when, plop, there was the toast, up on the ceiling. Whatever he'd done to the tension of the spring, obviously he'd now done it too much. And what finalised my decision to take the darn thing back was when a friend who was staying with us just happened to bend over the toaster while reaching for the cornflakes. Well, now, personally, I think he now looks rather dashing with an eye patch. But his insurance assessor's not having it at all. So back to the shop I went. And this time it took 10 months, because the man in the electric shop said he had some kind of staff trouble. Apparently the crew on his yacht had mutinied. Anyway, it meant another lengthy stretch of ruined breakfast and battered and blackened toast slices. But when the toaster came back this time, you can be absolutely certain we treated it very warily. After inserting the bread, we stood well back. But thank heaven, there was no more of this sort of mortar gun action. After the required 2 minutes, the bread just slipped up and stayed solid and secure in its slot. The only thing was, it wasn't toast. Not the slightest tinge of that lovely gold colour. It just pure, unsullied white. And what made this so peculiarly depressing was that it was a piece of brown bread. So, of course, I am now suing. I'm putting in an account for 18 months of ruined mornings, an account for a complete repaint job on the ceiling, an account for doctor's bills and damages for my one-eyed friend. And if that chap in the shop quibbles, I shall point out to him that I haven't also included the price of all those blackened and wasted slices of bread. Or as the old Romans used to say, there is no account in for toast.
Are entirely true. Now, by your votes, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story, but nevertheless, for the entire contest as a whole, Dennis Powell and Frank Muir win that, and this brings to an end this edition of My Words.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.